the safest thing to say is that canoes reached their most advanced form in North America and the highest form of engineering in North America based on skills of the builders, their design, and the materials available.
From the river to the valley to the sea.
Welcome to the Mississippi Valley Traveler Podcast. I'm Dean Klinkenberg, and I've been exploring the deep history and rich culture of the people and places along America's greatest river, the Mississippi, since 2007. Join me as I go deep into the characters and places along the river, and occasionally wander into other stories from the Midwest and other rivers. Read the episode show notes and get more information on the Mississippi at MississippiValleyTraveler.com. Let's get going. Welcome to episode 22 of the Mississippi Valley Traveler podcast. I've got a fun conversation for you today. I have a nice chat with Mark Nugel, who is co-author of Canoes, A Natural History in North America, which he wrote with Norman Sims. It's a beautiful book, a tome, a classic coffee table book, richly illustrated, great storytelling, very well written account of the history of this boat we take for granted that had its own sort of trajectory in North America. In this episode, we talk about the history of the canoe in North America and get into topics around canoe design and construction, and he'll even throw out a few tips you can use if you feel like building your own. We'll discuss the two basic types of canoes in North America, bark and dugouts, and we'll get into variations in canoe design that were engineered for different tasks. We also talk about the ways canoes were often dressed up with ornamental touches, which were unique to a tribe or a person. We'll then get into a little discussion of the role of canoes in the fur trade, fairly brief discussion about that, then transition into recreational paddling and the growing list of options for materials we use to build a canoe today. And then we'll finish with a couple of stories from Mark about memorable moments on canoe trips that he's taken. As always, thanks to my Patreon supporters. Your support makes this podcast possible. If you want to join the community, go to patreon.com/DeanKlinkenberg and you can pledge there. If that's not your thing, you can always buy me a coffee. Want to know how to do that? Go to MississippiValleyTraveler.com/podcast, and there'll be a link you can follow there to buy me a coffee and feed my caffeine habit, which would be much appreciated. And now, let's get on to the interview. Mark Nugel is a journalist and journalism educator who is chair of the Department of Emerging Media at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's the author, co-author, or editor of 8 books and is a frequent writer and speaker on environmental issues. His book, written with Norman Sims, Canoes, A Natural History in North America, was published by the University of Minnesota Press. Welcome to the Mississippi Valley Traveler podcast, Mark.
Thanks, Dean. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you today. I'm such a big fan of your book on canoes and natural history. It's an absolutely gorgeous book, for one thing, with richly illustrated. I love the depth of storytelling and descriptions of how canoes were built and how people use them. What was your connection with canoes before you wrote this book?
Well, it was a lifetime in canoes. That was the start. Norm and I had similar experiences. We're both from the Midwest. Norm passed away last year, but we're both from the Midwest. He's from Illinois and I was from Iowa, and we grew up in canoes. I think I was introduced to a canoe when I was probably about 10 or 11 years old by my father, who purchased one of the early fiberglass canoes in the late 1960s. He's an early adopter kind of guy, so when he saw the new materials for canoes, he jumped on it right away. And we live close to a lake and close to the Iowa River. So, you know, summers and evenings after school were spent in a canoe, fishing, canoeing, swimming, whatever it might be. And it stuck, you know, all those years later, it stuck with me.
So you, as I understand it, you still take a lot of canoe trips. You're still out in canoes pretty regularly these days and have been for much of your adult life.
Correct. I usually try to do 3 or 4 trips to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness in northern Minnesota or the Quetico National Park in Canada, although that's, of course, been closed the last few years. But BWCA trips are a big part of my life. I take my family along at least once a year. I go with a group of friends at least once a year, try to get up there, smaller groups or solo as much as I can. And these are, you know, shorter trips, canoe camping trips that would be 5, 6, 7 days across that wilderness.
Yeah, I'm a little envious that you live close enough to be able to take advantage of those opportunities to go to places that are still undeveloped, like the Boundary Waters and Quetico. Let me ask this: what defines a canoe? Like, how is a canoe different from other boats?
Well, it's long and skinny. Usually it's open deck. That is to say, it has no deck or just a very, very short deck. And it's propelled with the occupants facing forward with paddles rather than oars. So the paddles, of course, are not fixed to the gunwales where oars are fixed to the gunwales in oar locks. So when we think about a canoe, we think about a long, narrow, lightweight boat without decks, propelled by paddles with the paddlers facing forward. That's the basic definition. You might, and the follow-up question, of course, is how does it differ from a kayak, which is a common question. And a kayak has a deck and a canoe does not. A kayak is usually paddled with a double-bladed paddle, whereas a canoe is usually paddled with a single-bladed paddle, although I use a double-bladed one when I'm by myself, as do many, many others too. But the big difference is usually the presence of a deck and how low you sit in the water, how much water line and how much draft the boats have.
And canoes have a very long history in North America. Can you just describe a little bit how far back we think people have been building and using canoes in North America?
Well, thousands of years for sure. Carbon fiber dating on, or sorry, carbon, I'm thinking of carbon fiber boats. I have some carbon repair to do later today, so it's on my mind. Carbon fiber boats are new. Carbon dating takes us way back thousands of years to the dugout boats that have been discovered in places like Noonan's Lake in Florida and elsewhere. 5,000 years is probably a decent estimate, and it could be thousands of years before that with these types of dugout boats. Those boats will survive being buried in the muck in the bottom of a lake, you know, without the oxygenation that happens to destroy the wood. And we've seen some of those resurrected all over the country in the last few years. So I'm going to guess, 5,000 years minimum, but it could be closer to 10.
Mm-hmm. Are they unique to North America? Are there canoes other parts of the world?
Yes and no. They were most well-developed in North America, that we can say for certain. But we could also see boats that look a lot like canoes in places like Siberia and, of course, South Sea Islands. There's distinct differences between all of those boats, which are kind of highly technical. But I think the safest thing to say is that canoes reached their most advanced form in North America and the highest form of engineering in North America based on skills of the builders, their design, and the materials available.
Mm-hmm. Was there something unique about North America that made this like an epicenter of canoe technology then? Or?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. First of all, the indigenous tribes that lived in what became Canada and the United States needed boats to travel because it's a water-based culture, especially in Canada, of course, but northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, those places too, northeast United States. It's a water-based culture and you had to get around via some sort of watercraft. That was primarily in that region. And then secondly, it was the availability of the materials and you needed the proper kinds of wood to be able to build boats and have them last and be seaworthy, and the birch bark tree was probably is key to that, and that's the region where the boats became sort of their peak of development. In the areas where the birch bark trees weren't available, when you start to get farther south or farther to the Midwest, you've got dugout canoes, which are a lot harder to handle, a lot more heavy, somewhat more difficult to build, depending on how you look at it, if you have Stone Age tools or not, and just a little bit harder to manage in terms of portaging and so forth. They're really, really hard to portage, as a matter of fact. So you want something light and fast and easy to fix if it breaks, and that's what the birch bark gave you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into those a little bit more then. I'm lucky enough to travel along, you know, the Mississippi in various places, and I don't imagine birch bark canoes, aside from the fact there aren't birch trees very far south, birch bark canoes might be a little less ideal on the big open waters of the lower Mississippi, whereas the dugout canoes would be really hard to manage from, you know, Itasca State Park to Bemidji, for example. So the birch bark canoes, let's kind of start there. Like, what are the basics for how those boats were built? What materials were involved in construction?
So basic birch bark canoe needs a tree that became known as a canoe birch, paper birch. And one of the key things to note, Dean, in these types of constructions is the reason the birch tree bark works so well is that the grain of the wood runs differently than how we normally think of the grain of the wood in a hardwood tree. If you think of an oak tree or an elm tree, the grain runs vertically with the trunk of the tree up and down towards the sky, where in a birch tree, it's a circumference situation. So the bark, the grain in the bark circles around the tree rather than running it up and down. Well, that makes the bark in part a lot more flexible. And it's the flexibility that allows it to be bent into shape and crafted into shape with boiling water and so forth, and the structure to give it that nice, beautiful silhouette that we come to know as the canoe. Other barks were used, but not as well. Elm bark was probably the second most popular bark to be used, but you can tell a canoe made from elm bark and a canoe made from birch bark in about 2 seconds. It just doesn't fold up as nicely because of the way the grain runs and the inflexibility of the bark. But the birch trees proved perfect for this. And of course, they were also used for baskets and teepees and footwear and a number of other products as well because of their utility. But the canoe itself became kind of the pinnacle of the construction with the use of that particular tree bark. And then in addition to birch, you needed thwarts, you needed a gunwale, you needed flooring and ribs, perhaps a deck. And in those cases, you almost always got cedar, which is a really light but also waterproof wood, has a lot of oil in it, and also is readily available. So birch trees up in my part of the world are all over the place. Cedar trees are all over the place. So the ribs tended to be made of cedar. Also very flexible, very light, and the sometimes the gunwales are cedar, sometimes the gunwales are spruce. It kind of varies from location and whichever particular tribe is making the boat. You can see variations there in things like the deck, and then tying it all together is the other issue. You needed something that this is of course before nails or tacks, and you needed something to rope it all together. And so that tended to be the roots of a black spruce tree. And they're all over up here as well. So you've got the cool thing about the black spruce is the roots are very shallow. So once you find a tree and you find a root that's about the diameter of your little finger, you can start to pull on it and it probably won't be more than about 6 inches below the surface of the ground. So if it's loose soil, you can pull up 40, 50, 60 feet of it pretty easily. And then you've got a rope. Now, the issue with tying it onto your canoe and tying your gunwales to the hull is that you've got a rope, but it's completely round. And if you want it really tight, you need one side that's flat. And you need the flat side. If you can kind of envision the flat side being the downside, so to speak, that's against the hull and the the gunwale to make it as tight as it can be. So you had to take that route, maybe 60 feet, about the diameter of your little finger, and split it right down the middle in half. And that's hard. I'm just here to tell you that that's a very hard thing to do, to keep that knife straight and for 60 feet. Because if you slip, all of a sudden you've got 50 feet, and then you've got 45 feet, and then you're starting over again real quick. So black spruce would be the tree that ties it all together. You could use tamarack if you needed to, and there's some other sparks or some other roots that would work as well. And then you need to make the glue, so to speak, the pitch that holds it together. And this is the stuff people, when you think of birch bark canoes, you see the black stripes, right? It's a white, usually the boats are white with black stripes. And by the way, that's a separate issue that we'll get into. But the pitch is usually a secret formula that the natives discovered that has usually bear fat and then sap from that black spruce tree where they found the roots, and then usually a little charcoal mixed into it too to give it that black color. So when you cook it long enough, it comes into the consistency, kind of like the old bubble gum that we used to chew as kids, the big pink squares, you know, Bazooka Joe kind of gum. After you work on it for a half hour with your jaw, it's that kind of consistency where you can stretch it out and smear it against the seam, and then it'll harden and be pretty waterproof, really. You're going to get some leakage, but it's pretty waterproof. And the beauty of it is, if you need to stop and fix a leak, you just pull your boat over and look for a tree, and you know, or maybe you've got a little cup of it in the bow anyway, but you can patch it pretty quickly with some sap and maybe a little animal fat.
So there were several obvious advantages than the birch bark canoes. They were light, you know, for those frequent portages. They weren't so cumbersome to move from, you know, across land when you needed to portage. They were fairly, you know, the materials were readily available to build them. They were abundant in the areas. They could be fixed on the fly, which, you know, they are kind of, if you hit a rock, you know, you're probably going to be doing a repair pretty soon after that, right? So those are pretty cool. That's the basic design. Weren't there also some variations in the engineering for birch bark canoes depending upon how they would be used?
Correct. And it varied from tribe to tribe, and usually that meant region of the continent to region of the continent, and what they were used for. So for example, an ocean going canoe, like on the Pacific Northwest, would be a dugout made out of cedar, and that would be 22 to 30 feet long or longer, and hold maybe a dozen paddlers, but have very high, stem and stern would be high for big waves, and the gunwales would be high. Usually would have seats for paddlers in that kind of circumstance, because they would be either going out going fishing or going spearing for seals and things like that. Whereas a canoe made for collecting wild rice in northern Wisconsin is going to be a very different design altogether. It's going to be long and not quite so narrow, but probably without seats, and then have a relatively flat hull, wide flat hull to hold the rice as you paddle through rice beds and knock the wild rice off into the bottom of your canoe. So those boats are going to look very different. And the other differences would be boats with a high rocker. This is like the stem and the stern that are curved upwards, more like in a banana shape. Those are going to be boats built for fast rivers where you can turn on a dime and spin the boat around in a hurry if you have to. Whereas other boats that are made for lakes won't have those high rockers. The keel of the boat will be touching the water at a longer distance because they don't have to turn on a dime necessarily. They need more stability in other ways. So it depends on the tribe. It depends on the uses that the tribe put them for, and then the materials that they were made with as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things I'd never really thought about until I read your book. Was, you know, in the traditional birch bark canoes, there were no seats, right? So you would be kneeling, I guess, or as you paddled.
Correct. The indigenous people tended to kneel, although they also stood, depending on the need. But kneeling was the more traditional way. And it really wasn't until the late 19th century, I want to say. If you look at some of the early boats built by white settlers in the mid-19th century in Canada, where the process of sort of building the boats with by white settlers instead of the tribes started to happen, they mimicked the native designs. And the first boats that the whites built also had no seats. But pretty soon, as boats become less of a utilitarian vehicle and more for sport, you found seats being used for people who like to fish, for example, or recreational use. Seats are started to be added by the white builders, and then that's really one of only two sort of changes in the boat's design. One of the things that Norm and I say in the book that we're pretty confident of is that there are only two artifacts that Native American builders built that were unimproved upon by white settlement. In other words, they were perfectly engineered by the time Europeans got here. One was the canoe. There was really no improvements on the basic engineering of the boat. It's the same boat now as it was 5,000 years ago. And the other was the snowshoe, which the Europeans were not familiar with either. So those were engineered to kind of their pinnacle design and remain that way. Now, materials change, of course. The addition of seats, you could add that. The addition of sails occasionally would be part of that as well. Sails weren't known to the North Americans either and were brought by Europeans, but weren't very much in wide use either. They tended to be kind of a small niche.
Right. Sails on a canoe tend to be not very practical on rivers that bend and twist a lot. So you catch the wind for a minute and then it's gone. And
it wouldn't be my choice of travel. And the sails that I've seen on canoes, and they're not made for sails anymore, of course, but you can see some antique boats out that still have masts and a step and so forth. But they tend to have too much sail area in them. A real sailor, I say real sailor, a sailor who's experienced will look at a canoe sail and go, that's way too much sail. You're going to dump it. And you almost always do. When we looked at evidence of canoe races from the Canada and the U.S. in the late 19th century, they had sailboat canoe races based on sails, and the winning boat would tip over six times. I mean, it was not probably sustainable.
That's a pretty low bar then for winning a race if you're tipping over six times.
Right. Well, that's a person that has too much sail or just isn't very good at it.
Right. So was the Rob Roy, was that one of the canoes that had a sail on it?
Correct. The original Rob Roy by John McGregor looks to us probably more like a kayak because it had a deck. It's probably 10 to 12 feet long. Some of them, well, there were several Rob Roys, but the one I've seen in the museum, in one of the museums was short, has a deck, but it also has a mast for a sail and a step. And it was for one person. McGregor went alone and he stored his stuff underneath the deck to keep it dry, of course. And that sort of worked. Mm-hmm. But remember, he sailed 1,000 miles and mostly paddled really, but he did put the sail up occasionally across Europe and elsewhere. But the design was transferred to the U.S. and found some popularity, although in the northeastern United States, you saw some Rob Roy, people like Nessmuk and others use that design. But they were mostly long-distance travelers who went by themselves and needed to store gear and keep it somewhat dry. It would be similar to a kayak, except of course it has a sail and it sits a lot higher out of the water than a kayak does. Mm-hmm. But you could see similarities in the design if you look hard enough.
There was a journalist with a couple of buddies who traveled in Rob Roy canoes a lot down the Mississippi. I think 1879 or so was when they did their trip. I forget how far south I got. I think they started around Itasca. And made it at least to the Twin Cities and then maybe a little further south from there.
and then wrote two or three articles about their experience. So I know if you're not familiar with that, I'd be happy to send you the.
Yeah, that'd be great. I love reading the old stories, and I love them even more if they're true.
I'm pretty sure these were true, unlike some of the other canoe trips I read about. Like, yeah. William Major is another story, but
right.
So one thing I forgot to ask about is the paddles for the birch bark canoes. What were they typically made of, and were they composites of different materials, or were they cut from a single piece of wood, or?
Yeah, normally cut from a single piece of wood. And again, it would be the availability of whatever trees were nearby. It could be ash. It could be something lighter than ash as well, like in the cedar family. And the paddles were among the easiest things to make, so they could be expendable in those days. But they tended to be one piece of wood. And the paddle shapes were different depending on what they were used for. So a voyageur's paddle is going to look very different than the paddle used by somebody on a slow or on a big flat lake, where more propulsion might be needed, but fewer strokes. A voyageur's paddle is going to be long and skinny because they used it so much. It needs to be super light and doesn't have to have the big sort of beaver tail shape, flat shape, because it's too heavy and too hard to pull through the water if you're doing a million strokes a minute. So different paddles for different uses. And then, of course, people that did like ricing, for example, may not have used a paddle at all, but a pole, mm-hmm. and just pulled themselves along in the shallower waters where they could do that.
I had a chance to get a little taste of wild ricing with a friend a few years back, and I discovered the poling is a lot harder than it looks. It takes a lot of practice to do that well.
It does, and you've got to have good balance. You know, when I was a kid, and maybe you had this too, Dean, where, you know, my father in particular said, don't stand up in the canoe. You know, that was just one of the rules, because if you did, especially when you're 10 or 11, your balance may not be, at least not, mine wasn't, you know, in you go, and maybe you've taken somebody else with you. So to keep your balance is the key part. But, you know, you need the pole for balance, of course. But you need to also have if there's other people in the canoe, you need to have their cooperation. And I've capsized more than once, and anybody that's been in a canoe, well, as much as I have, you've capsized plenty of times. But you know, sometimes it's your fault, sometimes it's not. That's just all part of it.
Exactly. Well, so we covered the birch bark canoes. Let's move on to dugouts. So we have more artifacts of dugout canoes, as you mentioned, the finding. Could you just tell a little bit about what they found at Noonan's Lake in Florida, the breadth of that discovery?
Yeah, it's amazing, really. And so Noonan's Lake, first of all, I probably should say that there was a bad drought a few years ago. It's been a decade ago, probably now, or a little less than that, a bad drought. And the water levels of the lake, of course, recede in a drought. And at this particular drought was so severe that they receded to the point where people hadn't seen them that low, really, in recorded history in terms of the white settlement. And as the water level recedes and recedes and recedes, the evidence of old canoes buried in the bottom of the muck of the lake start to show up. And archaeologists are called in, and others are called in to take a look. And sure enough, there were pretty close to 100 dugout canoes that had settled in the muck of the lake, and they had been preserved by the mud and kept from deteriorating, as one would expect from a piece of wood sitting in water. And I think there ended up being 96, if I'm not mistaken, boats recovered. We're not all recovered. Some were left. Most of them were actually left in place, but a few were pulled out to be examined for all the things that you'd examine them for, and carbon dating and so forth. So they found to be thousands of years old. So if it wasn't for the drought, those boats probably never would have been found. But it also offers evidence that the boats had been in North America for many, 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 many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what kind of wood those particular dugouts were made from?
You know, I don't have it. I don't know if that's been determined off the top of my head. I know that in that particular region, there are a couple of different trees that lent themselves to this type of wood. Gomier tree would be one. Kapok tree would be another. I'm not sure if they were found in that region in Florida, and it's would be a little difficult to know if those boats were built there or, you know, built elsewhere and they got traveled there. But those would be the typical couple of the typical trees from the Caribbean, at least. So from that, more or less from that ecosystem. In other parts, the other dugouts would be cedar for the most part, redwood type canoes, because that was, those trees are big and those canoes could be strong and light and sort of waterproof because of the oil content.
Mm-hmm. We have, I live in St. Louis, as I mentioned when we before we started, and Cahokia Mound State Historic Site is just across the river from me. They have a dugout canoe that was found in Arkansas a few years back that was dated to about 600 to 700 years old. I think it's, I'm going to guess around 12 to 15 feet long, if I remember right. From bald cypress, they're pretty sure. It seems like every now and then one of these will turn up on a mud flat or sandbar somewhere as the rivers drop. And this one was found along the St. Francis River in Arkansas. Along the lower Mississippi, it seems like the cypress and maybe cottonwoods are also pretty commonly used for dugouts.
Cottonwood especially, yeah, because it's available and it grows large, of course, near the water. And you can get a pretty good sized boat out of an old cottonwood tree if you had to. I think the issue with cottonwood is the wood itself is so wet, so to speak. It absorbs so much water, it can be heavier. And then the problem you've got with it when you've got it dried out is it tends to warp. A little bit out of shape at times, so you won't get the most beautiful looking canoe you've ever seen, but it'll work. I mean, it'll work just fine. It just might not be on the cover of a National Geographic anytime
right.
soon.
It's not going to be a centerfold anytime soon, right?
No, but they do. And I've experimented a little bit with cottonwood as well, but it's just, it's kind of unsatisfactory. If you want a really smooth line, it doesn't, I suppose if a guy had a kiln and really worked at it, you could, but I'm pretty sure those didn't exist in the old days. So,
right. Some of those, but well, let's back up. So the basic process of constructing a dugout was pretty time consuming and arduous, as I recall. Can you just kind of describe the steps involved?
Yeah. Norm and I considered it sort of like building a cathedral in Europe, you know, where you need the whole community to pitch in and help out. So typically speaking, what would happen, and we're talking about pre-Iron Age materials here, so fire was key to doing this. So once you found a tree that was of suitable size, chopping the tree down was probably going to be problematic with stone tools. And so typically speaking, what would happen would be the base of the tree would be burnt. And so you start a fire around the trunk, right at the ground level, and burn away as much of that as possible until you could push the tree over. And then once the tree gets pushed over, you could use your hatchets and axes to chop the branches off. Okay, it would work okay. And then when you chop the branches off, that's your fuel for your fire. So then you start another fire and you heat things like water or rocks in it. And basically you just start scraping away until you get a flat side of the trunk or flat side of the tree. And then you start to dig it out. And digging it out usually meant with a sharp side of a rock or clamshells, which had a bit more of a knife edge to them. But the way to dig it out was to start a fire and put coals on the top of the cut side, and then scrape the charcoal out as the coals burnt into the hull. So hot water and coals, scrape, you know, several weeks later, you've got something that looks a lot like a canoe. And it was a process that took many people, of course, and somebody had to tend the fire and somebody had to have fuel for the fire and you needed, you know, the big clamshells and strong people to move it once it's finished. And Columbus brought an artist with him on his second trip here, and the artist did some sketches of of those canoes being, they had never seen a canoe, of course. And so they did some sketches of natives building canoes, and they got most of it right. Although one of the sketches, interestingly enough, has a square back, is a square back canoe, which I'm pretty sure wasn't needed for motors in those days. But the rest of it's probably fairly accurate in terms of the tools that they had available to them. And then, of course, once they got Iron Age tools, they've got knives and hatchets and so on that were steel or iron. They could really go to town in a lot more quickly.
Hey, Dean Klinkenberg here, interrupting myself. Just wanted to remind you that if you'd like to know more about the Mississippi River, check out my books. I write the Mississippi Valley Traveler guidebooks for people who want to get to know the river better. I also write the Frank Dodge Mystery Series set in places along the Mississippi. Read those books to find out how many different ways my protagonist Frank Dodge can get into trouble. My newest book, Mississippi River Mayhem, details some of the disasters and tragedies that happened along Old Man River. Find any of them wherever books are sold.
So once that basic process of excavating was finished, did they do anything else to the canoe before it was considered done at that point? Or
yeah, they oftentimes had to make the sides of the boat a little bit higher, depending on the size of the tree, of course. I've seen them done and seen evidence, you know, photographic and artistic evidence of them done where the basic hull shape is crafted out of a single log, let's say. But you want more free, you might want, well, depending on the use of the boat, you might want the sides of the boat to be somewhat higher. And so they would attempt to lash additional logs on the side to give you a little bit more, to give you a little bit more boat that way, depending on the size of the log that you start with. And again, most of these had, some had seats, but most of them did not have seats. That's pretty much it. And then off you go. You know, you tried to make it as narrow as possible. You tried to give yourself enough rocker to turn it if you needed to turn it. But most of the dugout boats were built for bigger waters like the ocean or the Mississippi. So you really didn't need to turn on a dime unless you were in the business of doing things like fishing or something where, you know, it's like, ah, there's my net over there. I got to turn, you know, I've got to make a sharp turn and in the current to go retrieve those fish. But for the most part, those big dugout canoes were built to carry gear over long distances or people over distances. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were good at.
I remember reading, I think there's some question as to the authenticity of some of these stories, but, when DeSoto led his army here to North America, after he died and the remaining people were fleeing downriver, they had these repeated assaults from indigenous people, descendants of Mississippian culture, the culture that started Cahokia. And one of the descriptions was a canoe or canoes that were so big that there were 90 men in them, 30 on each side and then 30 in the middle. That would be an enormous dugout canoe. I can only imagine the size of the tree.
I'm not sure about the authenticity of that account, but I don't doubt that there were trees large enough at the time for that would be possible. I've seen canoes 36 feet long, 38 feet long. It depends on how much room each person needed. It would probably not be an efficient fighting vessel with 90 people in it unless the plan was just to move them from point A to point B and board another ship, for example. Then yes, because you could outmaneuver a clumsy European boat pretty easily, especially with a bunch of paddlers. But if your idea was to storm another boat, then that would be one way to do it. My guess is that needed more than one tree in some fashion. And it would be interesting to see that. Now, in the upper part of the river and in the Canadian region, of course, Lake Superior, now I'm thinking, in the Great Lakes system, very common to have canoes 36, 38 feet long that were freight canoes, basically, to carry the beaver pelts back to Montreal. And they needed several people to paddle them as well.
Mm-hmm. So, right, and the dugouts, like birch bark canoes, there were variations in size depending upon what you needed it for. I think you had some interesting pictures, too, just showing different styles of ornamentation. Like, they weren't all just functional. Sometimes they would add ornamentation to them to add their signature style to them.
Some of the ornamentation was spiritual in a sense. Some of them was ownership, like a brand on a steer or something like that. Some of them, some of it was just artwork, really. You know, you see images that look something like maybe like cave paintings, for example, of animals or people. But you also see stars and the sun and fish and other things, and then just sort of symbols that probably stood for perhaps a tribe or a clan or maybe a time of year, depending on what the use was. One of the ways to tell whether you've got a real accurate birch bark canoe is by looking for those symbols, those etchings. The best of the birch bark canoes, the bark would be collected in late winter. And when the canoe is made, the outside of the bark of the tree is the inside of the canoe. So the white part of the bark that you see really should be the inside of the canoe. So all those Christmas tree decorations of a little bitty 6-inch white canoes with blacks, those are backwards, actually. Those are inside out. They're not accurate. The outside of the tree is the inside of the canoe. It shapes better that way. But the other reason that was late winter is there's a growth on the inside of the bark of the birch tree that is kind of a dark brown, that is only dark brown in late winter. And so just by looking at the hull, you can think, okay, that bark was harvested in March versus that bark was harvested in September, based on the color. The other thing that late winter harvest does for you is you can etch in it better. It's got a little bit of a kind of a fuzzy sort of covering to it and allows you to scrape those ornamental or spiritual symbols in it in that late winter bark that you can't do because that stuff goes away as in the heat of the summer, in bark that's harvested later in the year. So both color and sometimes the artwork on the boat, you can just determine when the tree was harvested by those kinds of clues.
Fascinating. Well, I think I probably got one of those poi canoes you mentioned that's hanging from my rearview mirror. But the bark is definitely facing the wrong direction.
Direction. Yep. You got to turn it inside out.
Yeah. So let's just kind of touch briefly on the canoes and the fur trade. There were some variations in the canoes that were built for the fur trade as well. Was this sort of the first major adaptation of canoes for European immigrants to North America?
Well, I think the thing to remember about the fur trade is that the French adapted the native customs, and the British did not. So the French were far more successful and had a 300-year reign in North America, more or less, Canada in particular, because they were smart enough to figure out that they couldn't improve on the design of the canoe, and they didn't try. Of course, they used indigenous paddlers and then eventually hired folks, their own folks, but they basically kept the same system in place that the natives have been using for trade and transport, because it's hard to beat a canoe for all those things, especially portability and speed. And one of the mistakes the British made when they got here was, being British, they had to do it their own way. And of course, anything they did was better than anything that the natives did, or the French for that matter. So they started to abandon the canoe culture in terms of the trade, and they were never as successful. They were never as successful as the traders. And of course, their empire here didn't last as long either, in part because economically they weren't making a go of it as well as they should have been. They attempted to bring British style boats over, and British style boats just are not going to work for the most part in places like Canada, where there's multiple rivers and lakes and portages and and you got to carry stuff, and you got to carry the boats, and you got to be able to steer them, and you got to be able to face forward and all of those things. So that's a real key, I think, that is sometimes not as well understood as it should be.
Mm-hmm. So for a while, this might have been in your book, I'm trying to remember, it seems like for a certain period of time in the fur trade, most of the canoes that were the French were using were actually built by indigenous boat builders.
That's correct. The Huron, there were other tribes, of course, many Algonquin tribes, but there were they took advantage of native builders and their skills, and instead of trying to do it themselves, they just sort of hired them out, basically. And people like the Hudson's Bay companies, like the Hudson's Bay Company, just hired native builders and said, you know, provide us with X number of canoes, and off we go. And that's what they did. It wasn't really until toward the end of the fur trading era, depending on when you date it, that process starts to end. The French had long since left by then, for the most part. And then you started to get some white builders basically copying native designs, but moving us into an era, and a lot of the big birch trees were gone. It was difficult to find materials. Pretty soon you had to be crafting a canoe from three birch trees rather than one, and all these things lend themselves to the idea of just building a wooden boat rather than a birch bark boat or a dugout boap, but a wooden boat, maybe a lapstrake boat or something like that, that was nailed together. By 1850, you started to see the use of tacks and nails, and we can kind of date it from there.
Mm-hmm. Is that around the time when the canoes started to shift from purely functional to more recreational use too?
Right. And then by about 1870 or so, you know, people still use them for work vehicles, of course, and transportation. But you also started to see sportsmen and women using them for fishing and camping and racing and so forth. And that ushers in an era of a new type of design of canoe, or materials-wise, because, again, it was hard to find birch bark. So you've got substitutes for birch bark. At first, the canoes were built just from wooden slats, but they were leaky as hell and not satisfactory to anybody. And so by the 1890s, you started to see a canvas covering, and the era of wood and canvas canoes starts in the late 1890s for real. And essentially the canvas replaces birch bark as the covering of choice.
Hmm. And I guess, though, it's interesting. I don't know that I've ever been in a canvas covered canoe. So is that still a technique that we're using very often? Or
There are a few builders around that will build you a wooden canvas canoe. And there's an active small community, of course, that keeps that alive. Many of the boats that you see that are wooden canvas now are older. Wooden canvas, by the end of World War II, well, certainly by 1950, the wooden canvas, the major manufacturers had shifted over to aluminum or will. Places like Old Town in Maine, of course, and others, Thompson in Wisconsin, made wooden canvas canoes. And it's essentially a birch bark canoe with a canvas covering with a solution smeared onto the canvas to make it waterproof. Those boats are beautiful boats. They tended to be, because you could shape the canvas and the boat any way you want, they tended to copy Native American designs and sizes as well. And you could paint them so they could look pretty. They tended to absorb water. An 85-pound boat at the beginning of the season might be a 105-pound boat at the end of the season. So they did get a little heavy. But they were pretty sturdy, and all you had to do really, if after 3 or 4 years, was tear off the canvas and put more canvas on, and you're good to go again. And those boats will last a very, very long time if you take care of them. Mm-hmm. But they're somewhat expensive to make, and of course, canoe builders are always looking for either lighter or cheaper, and so that pretty much doomed wooden canvas boats by about the late 1940s in the marketplace.
I'm guessing the waterproofing coat did not include bear grease or any of those other traditional components, though.
Sometimes it had a silver, a very toxic silver component to it that proved to be problematic. But nowadays, that formula is a closely guarded secret. You can buy it occasionally from, but many of the builders don't let on as to what they actually use to cover their canvas with, and it's kind of an interesting subculture.
All right, so aluminum became kind of the material of choice beginning around World War II then, I guess, around the 1940s?
So what happened was the Grumman manufacturing company in New York, of course, were making Hellcats for the Navy, and once World War II ended in 1945, they didn't have much of a market for their aluminum fighter planes anymore. So their chief engineer had gone on a long canoe trip in the Adirondacks with a wooden canvas canoe and came back and said, "Oh man, this is heavy." And it was, and he thought he could make it lighter out of aluminum. And there was some aluminum boat building in the earlier part of the century by the French and others, but it had never gone anywhere. But he took basically two airplane wings and flipped them around and bolted them together and thought he had something. And the aluminum Grumman canoe was born, and it was inexpensive and tough and durable and somewhat lightweight enough and relatively cheap to manufacture that it caught on. And by 1950, it leads the market in canoe sales. So for the first time that we were able to determine, if you look at overall sales by year, 1950 is the first year that aluminum canoes lead the market, and they do so for probably the next 25 years.
Wow. When I went to Boy Scout camp, I hate to admit what year that was, but we'll just say a while back. I'm pretty sure those aluminum canoes were already, 25 or 30 years old at that point. They last a long time.
Last a long time. That's what they're meant for. And they, it was $100, $130, maybe $160 at their peak. You don't have to have a garage to store them. You can leave them outside all winter. It's not going to hurt them any. You could throw them, underneath your cabin. Nobody's going to bother them. Mice are not going to chew through it. Nothing, squirrels don't bother them. Nothing wrong with that at all. Now, they're super hot on a hot day in the summer, and they're noisy as heck. If you want to sneak up on some fish and you drop your Pepsi can in the bottom of the boat, they had some drawbacks, but all in all, they it's hard to talk to a canoeist of our age, especially, who has not been in an aluminum canoe and had some memories of it.
They're kind of heavy compared to some of the contemporary materials too. But so what are some of the more interesting materials being used today for construction of canoes?
Well, by the 1960s, you could start to see the writing on the wall for the aluminum boats because of the introduction of fiberglass. Of course, and there are plenty of fiberglass makers on the market. And then you've got Kevlar, which also was invented in 1964, as a matter of fact, Kevlar canoes. And then starting in even a later period, you've got carbon fiber and its various forms. So you've got those are all on the high end. And then on the low end, you've got the plastics, various kinds of ABS type plastics as well. And so there's a wide range of materials on the market now. You could, if you looked hard enough, you could buy everything from a new wooden canvas canoe to a highly sophisticated carbon fiber canoe that might weigh less than half of what the wooden canvas boat makes. And there are still even three or four or five birch bark builders in the upper Midwest. Rarely can you get a boat made from one tree. But you can still get them if you want them. And then occasionally you'll see some come up on the used market as well. But there's a boat for just about every interest if you want to do so. And the development of these new synthetic fibers gets more sophisticated every year. It's amazing. I mean, you can buy a canoe now that is essentially the same materials as a Tour de France bicycle. And equally tough. Now it's not going to be inexpensive, of course,
right?
But it would be the latest and greatest in terms of weight and durability and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So it is interesting to me, like there is this timelessness, as you said, in the design of canoes. And one of the lines that I really loved in your book was this idea that, you know, a person who was living a couple thousand years ago could show up today and look at a canoe and pretty much know what to do with it, right? They wouldn't need anybody to orient them to how to use this thing.
No instruction needed. They could probably whittle a paddle out of a nearby tree, hop in it, and off they'd go. And that's what we say. That's one that the pinnacle of design was reached many, many, many years ago. It's just a question of materials after that. And you know, that's the fun part about it is I think Sigurd Olsen wrote once. I'm paraphrasing here, but a person in a canoe has a connection to all canoes ever, because essentially what he's saying, it is the same design, it is the same boat.
Yeah.
And there is that nostalgia that goes along with it and a little bit of history and so forth.
So the romantic in me though, wonders a little bit, we don't build canoes anymore from the materials that are from the environment around us. And they're, you know, most of the materials are manufactured from materials we get from anywhere around the world at this point. So have we lost anything by paddling around in canoes that don't have that connection to the natural world, so that direct connection to the natural world that they used to have?
Well, yes and no. It is still possible. I built a canoe out of white cedar, mostly white cedar, from wood gathered from near the Boundary Waters, for example. Now, I say that because it was a wood-stripped canoe, and of course, it's covered with fiberglass after the wood hull is built. So it is a combination of old and new. So a person with about eighth grade shop skills could do that if one wanted to, and I would recommend it. I actually learned probably more about hull design building my own boat than I would have from a book. That was one of the things that Norm had built four or five boats prior to our starting on the canoe book, and he said if you really want to learn about hull design, you really should make your own boat first. And I'm like, ha ha ha, yeah, right. But I have some skills, and so I did that, and he was right. It gave me a more total understanding of the boat, and it was fun too. And it was fun. So, but it's a combination of old technology and new materials.
Mm-hmm. And you had this opportunity, as I recall, because there had been a derecho that had come through.
Correct.
That area. Yeah. Was this in Ketiko, or I forget?
It was in both sides of the border, U.S. It was right along the border, as a matter of fact, and you know, tens of thousands of trees blown down. Now, you can't collect the trees from the parks themselves, that's not allowed, but from cabin owners and farmers and so forth who bordered the area lost a lot of trees, and that's where I got most of the materials. Mm-hmm. And the white cedar tree is native to Minnesota. It's also the lightest of the cedars. If you had a cubic yard of it, it's maybe 25 pounds or something like that, maybe less. So you've got a really strong, lightweight wood that you can start with. And it's local. And there's plenty of white cedars around. It's not like there's a shortage of those. So,
right.
So we just kind of scrounged around and, you know, found enough wood to build a 16-foot Canadian style canoe, and off we went.
So how many miles does that canoe have on it now?
Well, it had probably, oh boy, that's a very good question. It probably had 40 or 50 trips to the Boundary Waters over the years, plus the area lakes in the Twin Cities. And that one was sold. My fleet rotates, Dean, quite a bit. I'm never satisfied, I guess, but I think it's now at a cabin in northern Minnesota being gently tended for and used on holidays by the purchaser.
So I'm cognizant of the time, and we probably need to wrap this up pretty soon. And I'm just curious, like, do you have a story about a particular canoe trip that really stands out, like something you really could not have done without being traveling by canoe?
Well, I don't have a particular, I mean, I have lots of stories, few that we have time for. But I would say in general, because of the quiet nature of the boat, that it allows you to have an interactions with wildlife that you would not otherwise have. Even in the hiking circumstance, you can sometimes sneak up on animals when you're on foot. But in my experience, it's not quite as easy. Whereas in a canoe, especially in a smaller bodies of water, and you're so quiet, especially if you're not talking or you're not making other noises, that I've had the opportunity to be closer to wildlife than in any, you know, any other circumstance outside of a zoo. You know, many experiences with moose and calves and bears and, you know, waterfowl of all sorts, fish, of course. All those things happen because you can be quiet and part of the natural world without disturbing it very much. That would probably not happen if you were in a motorboat or you know, another kind of circumstance. You'd scare them away.
Right.
And those are the kinds of things I think about rather than one particular story. It's just moments where I might be, a couple of years ago, I was paddling down a river with a friend, and we were actually going downstream, and a moose was standing on the shore about, oh, I was going to say about 75 yards away on the western shore, and it decided it wanted to be on the east side of the river instead of the west side right before we got to it. So it jumped in and swam right in front of us, you know, not 20 yards away, if even that. And moose is a darn good swimmer, by the way. And the part that I remember the most is we just stopped and watched it and floated, and it swam all the way across. And then it came out of the water at a portage, and it shook like a dog, which I had never actually seen up. And I've now since seen it before, but I hadn't seen it at that. It shook like a dog, which was amazing. And then it just walked down the portage like it was going to the next lake, which I'm sure it probably was. So that was a marvelous experience that you would not have otherwise seen. Now, the other thing I thought of was, what if I was portaging my canoe the other direction and the moose was coming? On a fairly narrow
on the
portage.
Trail?
Yeah, that would be another circumstance, but...
That's fantastic. I think I completely agree. I think that's one of my favorite, the reasons I love being in a canoe so much is it does feel like it's easier to interact with the rest of the natural world because you're quieter. It's more like you're a part of that world rather than, you know, just zipping through it. So, well, thanks so much for sharing that and for your time today. Is there a place where you keep an update on what you're working on next? If there's a way people want to follow your work?
You know, I've got a website, marknewsel.com, that I try to keep up when school's not in session. And then on Facebook, there's a canoes page where I post news stories as they come up on canoes and canoeing. And of course, every time a new boat comes bubbling up from the bottom of an old boat comes bubbling up from the bottom of a lake, I try to post about it. And different things with manufacturers, and sometimes they've got a different kind of plastic that they're attempting to use and new materials. And so either of those two places are open to the public, I guess you could say. And then, of course, you know, we love feedback. I love feedback from our book, all kinds of feedback. I give a lot of talks around the country, around the Midwest mostly. I got to tell you, at almost every talk, somebody thinks that I'm the Antiques Roadshow guy about canoes, which I am actually not. I don't know if they have a canoe guy, but almost every time somebody will come up to me with an old photograph and say, this is Grandpa's canoe. And what they're really asking me is, it's worth anything.
Right. What can I get for this?
Exactly. And I usually have to say, it's worth a lot to you.
Yeah.
But absolutely. That's fun too.
So what's the name of the Facebook group then?
You just search for canoes in North America, and it'll pop up.
All right. I'll post a link to that in the show notes, too, so people can find it there, and to your website as well. And to, I guess, the University of Minnesota Press is the publisher of the book, so I'll post a link to there, too. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this. This was a fantastic conversation. And like I said, I absolutely love this book, and I think everybody should go get a copy now. Thanks for your time, Mark.
All right. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it so much.
And now it's time for the Mississippi Minute. Mark's story about his own memorable moments from canoe trips got me thinking about my own trips. I haven't had quite as many trips as Mark, but I do have a couple of memories that really stand out for me. In August 2014, I took a two-day trip near the Mississippi headwaters, beginning about 16 miles downriver from where the Mississippi begins at Lake Itasca. I began at Coffee Pot Landing, and I finished at Lake Irving at Bemidji. One interesting side note from this trip, the headwaters had apparently gotten 9 miles closer to Bemidji than they had a few years earlier when I compared my older Mississippi River trail map to the new one. I don't know who shaved off those miles. I'd put my money on Paul Bunyan, but I'm pretty sure it saved me some time. Later in the day of that first day's paddle, I somehow managed to miss the area where I had planned on camping that night, so I had to paddle on into a march through anxiety and doubt and into the golden hour. As the sun got lower and lower in the sky, I wondered if I'd have enough light remaining to get to the next campsite or if I should be figuring out how to sleep in the canoe. The river, though, wouldn't let me get too bent out of shape. The marsh glowed from the golden late-day light, the breeze disappeared, and I began to feel as calm as the world around me. I saw more wildlife in those late evening hours than I saw the whole rest of the day. Beavers, kingfishers, a trumpeter swan, lots of ducks, turtles, and more. I got to the campsite at Iron Bridge as the sun was setting, with just enough light remaining to set up my tent and get my gear inside before the mosquitoes carried me away. I was beat. 11 hours of paddling to cover 25 miles will do that. Of course, it would have been 31 miles on the old map, so lucky me. So it didn't really matter when I discovered that the batteries were dead in both of my lights. I guess I hadn't bothered to check those before I left. I just settled in and I went to sleep, which came easily. Spending hour after hour alone in the canoe, I began to realize that solo paddling on a river offers some valuable life lessons. For example, a lake looks much bigger when you're paddling on it into a headwind than when you're standing on a boat ramp admiring its beauty. Here are a few more life lessons I picked up from that river trip. Around every bend in the river, there's another bend in the river. You will get dirty and wet. Embrace it. Still water doesn't always run deep. No matter how mad your skills and how well you prepare, sometimes the wind and the current will force you into a bank anyway. The moment you stop paying attention is when you miss the trumpeter swan or you end up on a rock. It's impossible to always pay attention. Whether you drift or paddle hard, you end up in the same place. So what are some of your favorite paddling stories? What life lessons have you learned in a canoe or kayak? I'd love to hear your stories. Share them with me at MississippiValleyTraveler.com/contact. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to the series on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. I offer the podcast for free, but when you support the show with a few bucks through Patreon, you help keep the program going. Just go to patreon.com/DeanKlinkenberg. If you want to know more about the Mississippi River, check out my books. I write the Mississippi Valley Traveler guidebooks for people who want to get to know the Mississippi better. I also write the Frank Dodge Mystery Series that's set in places along the river. Find them wherever books are sold. The Mississippi Valley Traveler podcast is written and produced by me, Dean Klinkenberg. Original music by No Offense. See you next time.